I don't remember positively the name of the Russian scientist who visited with us and talked with Henry Brown about that. But it did start us off making a measurement of polarization, to which we only got upper limits of a few percent. But that was an interesting...
I think you're right. I don't remember any earlier experiments along those lines.
Well, I think Cambridge had done it.
On radio sources also?
I'm pretty sure, yes. Yeah. We were not the first to look for polarization in radio sources, but we were perhaps the second. Or was it Ryland Smith, I think, did it?
Yeah, I just don't remember.
Oh, it said the only published experiments appear to be those of Ryland Smith, who examined the intense sources Cygnus and Cassiopeia with an interference polarimeter.
So they only looked at the two biggest. Now, what was the feeling as to the emission mechanism of the radio sources at that time? Was it sort of a big unknown?
Well, I think certainly after that 1955 meeting, it was understood that it was synchronous.
But before then?
It was something of an unknown, yes. Going back to the polarization problem, it had just been discovered optically in the crab. That was the what was being talked of, and that was the reason why we looked for it in the crab.
Oh, is that one of the sources you looked for?
Yeah, we used Cygnus Cassiopeia in the crab. Cygnus Cassiopeia in the crab were the three that we looked at.
And Cass was known to be a supernova remnant. Well, no, that's not true. Its nature wasn't clear. It was a nebulosity and
that's
with high velocities, but whether it was a supernova remnant, I think, was under debate at that time.
Yes, I think you're right.
Well, that gives me a good coverage of the projects that you worked on at Jodrell. I might just ask one general question about the whole way Jodrell operated. It obviously was one of the leading radio astronomical centers in the early 50s, and to what do you attribute that? What do you think was the key ingredients?
The British got off to an early start in radio astronomy, and as of course so did the Australians. I think it was due very largely to Lovell's enthusiasm. Of course, he was a great pusher at getting things going. It started, of course, not in radio astronomy as we know it now, but in meteor radar.
Right.
And the 218-foot dish was built for a cosmic ray experiment to detect cosmic ray showers by radar.
That was the initial...
That was the initial thing.
Which was the thing that Lovell had proposed during the war. The idea was something that he had proposed in a paper during the war.
I see.
But I'd forgotten that was the original purpose. And was that experiment carried out?
Yes, I believe it was, with negative results. But that was before I went to Jodrell. And the dish had attempted to do a survey with that dish using an open wire feeder up the mast at about 100 megahertz. And it wasn't very satisfactory. And Henry came along and used a much better feed, but the coaxial feeder and a much better receiver and was able to do a satisfactory sky survey. I guess it was was partly because they got going so soon, I think. Partly because the meteor radar stuff turned out to be a very fruitful field. Mm-hmm. It lasted about 10 to 15 years, but during that time it was very fruitful. A great deal was learned about the high atmosphere from it. The observations were relatively straightforward. They were rather easy with the radars mm-hmm. that had been developed during the Second World War. Cambridge came into it. Was never in the meteor field, but they came straight into the radio astronomy mm-hmm. aspect. Ryle was probably more interested in cosmology and that kind of thing right from the beginning.
Right from the beginning, you think so?
From earlier on, maybe I shouldn't say right from the beginning, but I suspect that within a year or two of getting of finding that he could catalog radio sources, I suspect that was when he got interested in it.
And so that would be around 50 or 51, probably. So.
Yes, because
the 1C was published in 1950.
Yeah.
And so he was working on it in 49, probably.
Yes, yes. Because he did a little bit of solo work, too.
Quite a bit, yes. In the late 40s.
Yes.
That's why I was wondering when you said right from the beginning.
Yeah, okay.
He started off working on the Sun for 2 or 3 years.
That's right.
So the enthusiasm of Lovell, the fact of getting in early, any other aspects that you would...
Well, he had... There were a lot of good people, I think, associated with things in those early days. Hanbury Brown, there was a man called Clegg, who wrote a small book on radio astronomy with Lovell. He taught electromagnetism at Manchester University. I took one of his courses. He was an ex-RAF type who had worked a great deal on radar during the war. He was very good at putting up antennas and making them work. And I think he didn't get along too well with Lovell somehow or other. They didn't quite have the same style. And he eventually left. But he did an enormous amount of work in the early days getting the meteor radars going.
You bring up the question of the courses and so forth. How much optical astronomy did a research student at Manchester learn in those days?
Well, none. I was taking physics. And there was very little in the way of postgraduate coursework.
So this was an undergraduate course that you were talking about from Clegg?
Yes, that's right.
So as a research student, you took very few courses at all?
That's right. Mainly it's just a few seminars and things.
So what you learned was just from your own reading and in the literature?
Yes.
Did you more or less, in this reading of the literature, pay attention to the more traditional astronomical papers, or was it pretty much just reading the radio papers? And
I think a mix of the two.
Yeah.
I might just mention the business of people coming to the United States from England. Gordon Little, who's now, I think, at Boulder, was the first one to come, and then Alan Maxwell and various other people. I know I was third or fourth.
J.B. Evans?
Yeah, J.B. Evans came after me. I knew him very well at Jodrell. I think he came to Jodrell either 1 year or 2 years after I did. 1 year, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And we were very good friends there. And of course, Dave Williams had gone to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Dave Williams has now at Berkeley, worked at Marconi with Marconi in Canada for a number of years.
Now, what about this outflux?
I guess we heard from people who'd gone that. How interesting, what an exciting place the United States was, and it seemed like quite an adventure to come over here. So when I eventually got the opportunity, I came over, and I've never regretted it. Actually, what would happen was when I left Jodrell, I thought I was in fun to work in industry for a while and probably have rather better instrumentation and stuff to play with than we had at Jodrell. So I joined EMI. I'd been there for about just over a year, and one afternoon I had a phone call from Alan Maxwell, who was in London, and he was interested in the possibility of my going over and joining him at Fort Davis. So I went and had lunch with him, and he asked me to think about it, and I decided that it would be an interesting thing to do to come to the United States. So I came in August 1957, and I stayed at Fort Davis for 5 years.
Is it fair to say that there really weren't that many opportunities to do radio astronomy in Britain? It sort of saturated in terms of positions, and that it was expanding.
I could have stayed on at Jodrell if I'd wanted to.
So was the staff expanding then to that extent, at least that there were some positions for the best students anyway?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it was. You see, the 250-foot dish was not quite completed when I left, but quite a lot of work was going on building instrumentation for it, and I could certainly have stayed and worked.
Well, that would seem to be a very exciting prospect to have that thing coming on the air.
Yes, that's right, but I guess I was young and felt a change of horizons would be in order.
So you came? Did you live at Fort Davis immediately?
Yes.
And what did you find there? And what did you begin working on?
Well, The Fort Davis project had been going for about a year when I arrived there. Sam Goldstein and Govan Swarup were both working mm-hmm. there. I remember that the first day I went out to the site, Alan Maxwell introduced me to them, and I looked at the equipment, and he had this very complex antenna which would cover about four octaves or three octaves of the radio spectrum, and all these sweet frequency receivers, and I eventually looked at the got familiar with the equipment, and the sweet frequency receivers were of course mechanically tuned, and were getting a little bit the out of tolerance, and mm-hmm. the bearings and things were wearing, so I took one to pieces and changed some of the mechanical things in, put it together carefully, and aligned it mechanically somewhat better than it had been to start with, and that became one of my annual jobs for the 5 years that I was there, taking
a tune-up, so to speak.
Yeah, taking the sweet frequency receivers to pieces and tuning them
up. Was there any possibility in terms of the technology to make it electronically tuned? Was that just out of the question in those days?
I think it was kind of on the horizon, but yeah. Before I left Fort Davis, we had got a receiver that covered 2 to 4 gigahertz, sweet tuned using a backward wave oscillator, which wasn't very reliable, incidentally. The thought of doing that at the lower frequencies was mm-hmm. a possibility. Incidentally, I believe those receivers are still running. On the 28-foot dish. We eventually got two more of them, which were 25 to 50 and 50 to 100 megahertz. So we scanned all the way from 25 to 600. Those two were connected to a pair of dipoles. At about this time, Paul Wild had done a lot of work classifying solar bursts, and some of the main contributions of that particular work at Fort Davis were getting a regular and reliable solar watch going. Excuse me. So that we had good catalogs of radio bursts, and we could easily classify them into the four types: noise, storms, slow drift bursts, fast drift bursts, continuum, and then finally the type fives.
Are you implying that DAPTO at that time was not monitoring regularly, or?
I think.
Was it just a matter of the other half of the day?
Well, it was partly due to the other half of the day. I think they were monitoring fairly regularly. I don't think they had quite as good a time coverage as we managed to get to about 95% time coverage.
I'm not quite sure how much they had. They certainly were going well in those
yes.
days.
Yes, yeah. That's right. Another important thing was, of course, that the United States had a number of very good optical solar observatories, and one really wanted good coverage during those periods where we could correlate flares with solar radio bursts.
So which ones were you working with mainly? Which observatories?
Sac Peak and High Altitude Observatory. Mm-hmm. Oh, and then Gail Morton, who was a guy who worked for Lockheed, started a solar observatory on the West Coast, which turned out to be quite good. He produced a lot of very good solar data.
This is when the military was putting out money for it.
That's right. He eventually went to Australia, and I lost track of him. I don't know what's happened to him. We did a lot of work on the coincidences between different types of solar flares of different intensities with solar radio bursts.
Right. Before we get into the scientific results of that, let me just ask about the equipment. Is it fair to say that it was a direct outgrowth of Paul Wild's dynamic spectrographs?
The idea of using a dynamic spectrograph was the actual receivers were an outgrowth, I think, of the military. They who had they were made by AIL, mm-hmm. Who had made similar things for the military. They were classified, but I think it was generally known that they were used in the Mediterranean area for monitoring missiles and, mm-hmm. And all that kind of thing.
Or just radio communications.
Yeah, radio communications. That's right. That's right. You could stop them and tune them into a particular frequency.
Right. So what were the improvements? I think this had somewhat better specs than Wild Spectrograph.
Yeah, we went up to higher frequencies to 500 megahertz. We had somewhat, I think, flatter frequency responses. Those were the main things. We had a somewhat better antenna. We had, he had dipoles and things. We had a paraboloid that tracked with a very nice feed made by Henry Jasek.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that strikes me is that you had not worked on the sun at all, of course, at Jodrell, and yet you were quite willing to change the scientific thrust of what you were doing. Did that matter to you at all, or is it just a matter that you were happy to be doing radio astronomy.
Radio astronomy. Now, I was always considerably interested in the techniques as well as, and I still am, of course, as well as the astronomy.
Right. Okay. So now let's get on to the scientific results that came out of this monitoring. What would you say were the primary? The papers here seem to talk about correlations between cosmic rays and type 3 and 4 bursts.
Yeah, we did some of that. Then let me think. One of the things that we discovered was that there was a very strong correlation between type 4 bursts and polar cap absorption phenomena. And we wrote that up in a little Nature article. I think the Japanese just beat us to getting that into print. They had discovered it too.
I guess, was the reason that you were worrying about ionospheric effects perhaps more than you would have otherwise because of Alan Maxwell's
background? Yeah, I think perhaps so, yes.
What about the sun itself? What would you say were the things that you learned about the sun from this monitoring?
I never regarded myself as a solar physicist in any way, and I think we're doing this in a rather somewhat as an empirical fashion, but mm-hmm. we were interested in the qualitative description of the bursts
and correlations
and the correlations, and we were interested in the theories about how the bursts. How the bursts were produced. We weren't exactly, neither Maxwell nor I would ever regard ourselves as plasma physicists or theoretical physicists, theoretical astrophysicists. Alan was always trying to get Max Crook of Harvard, who was a great friend of his, to write a paper on the mechanisms of solar radio bursts, because Crook had quite a number of ideas. Mm-hmm. But I don't think he ever did. Alan used to try desperately to get some kind of notes from Crook that he put in some of the papers that we wrote.
This was a fellow in the Department of Physics at Harvard, or?
I think he's, I don't know whether he's applied physics or mathematics.
Mm-hmm. I just noticed here that it says in your Proceedings of the IRE paper in 58 that you have 10 times more sensitivity than anyone else, which means Wild's.
Yes.
Because greater sensitivity.
Fred Haddock started up about the same time on the Navy sponsorship, and there was a certain amount of I think competitive feeling between him and Alan.
What was the main source of the money for Fort Davis?
The Air Force.
The Air Force.
Through Sacramento Peak.
Oh, I see. It came via that.
Right. Ed Dennison of SAC.
That's right. Menzel.
Ed Dennison of SAC Peak was our contract monitor. Menzel, yes, had helped to set up SAC Peak in the early days.
Right. I was able to talk to him before he died.
Let's see. There was something that just crossed my mind. Oh, well, never mind.
What would you say were the primary differences that you saw in the way radio astronomy was developing in the late 50s in the U.S. as opposed to
There's a great deal more emphasis to centimeter waves. We had all started in England at meter wavelengths,
mm-hmm.
and the U.S. never really went through that. They partly because I think their centimeter wavelength technology was at a higher level, and they kind of jumped in there.
Well, also, I guess because they got started late, and that was the direction things were going.
Yeah. That's right.
But even the NRO group, though, in the late 40s was working at centimeter waves,
yes.
They never worked at anything lower than longer than 20 centimeters, I think.
That's right. 21 centimeters was about the longest wavelength. Right.
I guess that is generally true for the entire, all U.S. groups, with only a couple of exceptions. Okay, just to finish up, you were there till 1962?
Yes.
I believe, and then you went to
Stanford. Greswell, yes. Who at that time was hoping to make himself a large cylindrical antenna, but the money for it never came through.
A Cambridge type paraboloidal? Well,
it was going to be a cylinder that worked at 10 centimeters wavelength with some kind of a long line focus feed.
For primarily solar work, or
no, for the whole thing. He thought he was very keen on the idea of a growing array.
What kind?
A growing array. Or an instrument which you could add to.
Right.
And at that time, it wasn't so clear that you wanted resolution, but that you wanted collecting area. And the thought was you had a lot of these long trough-like cylinders
that
you could add to it and make it. A very large square array. It would have been a meridian transit instrument, largely.
I see.
And so I'm not, as things developed, that wasn't really the way to go.
And the money didn't come forth for that.
The money didn't come forth for
and
it.
And
no.
So the effort at Stanford shifted in what direction then?
Well, it shifted into making some paraboloids for a five element array.
Even that early?
Well, let me see. Maybe I'm. Maybe I should say that early. Stan Zisk was there at that time. We had some 30-foot dishes. I think it was three of them, and they with those were put on mounts and they worked at 10 centimeter. We did some 10 centimeter interferometry, and that led into the 2.8 centimeter array that Ron eventually built.
Okay, and just to finish off the. Your career, when did you become director of the VLA site?
Well, let's see, I joined NRAO in 72, I've been there just 5 years, the beginning of this year, in January 72. My title is Deputy Project Manager. I'm Deputy Jack Lancaster. Right. The exact date, which I kind of dig out of my files,
well, that's not that critical.
Like about 70.
Right.
74.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
That ends the interview with Dick Thompson at the VLA in New Mexico on 1st May 78.